Welcome to podcast number 35 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is January 29th, 2019, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Anthony M. Brown. He is an author of Move to Murder, Death of an Actress, and The Green Bicycle Mystery. They can be found at www.coldcasejury.com, coldcasejury, all one word, .com. Cold Case Jury books are gripping true crime mysteries from decades and centuries past, combining history with a real-life whodunit. Each book reads like a fast-paced thriller, taking the reader back in time to see the crime dramatically reenacted according to different theories. The evidence presented as exhibits in a special section is sifted and discussed. Before the author reveals his view on the case, readers are invited to deliver their verdicts on what most likely happened. Not quite crowdsourcing, but certainly a way for the average Joe to take a look at a case of years gone by and look at the evidence and determine what they see as being what happened and who did it. My guest is Anthony M. Brown. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. It's great to be on your show.
So tell me, how is it there in merry old England today?
Old England, it's overcast, it's damp, not too cold, to be honest with you. I would call it quite miserable, quite honestly.
Well, from talking to my Brit friends, that's a typical English day. So,
yeah.
Anyway, today here, as I'm talking to you, it's Wednesday, January 16th, and in New England, it's a little frosty and overcast here, but no snow, thank God. So, anyway, hey, I was really interested in speaking to you about your writing and about how you came into the world of true crime mysteries, and specifically what you've done now with your Cold Case Jury true crime collection. If you can just get me started down the road of how you got interested in all this and tell me the stories and explain things to me, I'd really, really appreciate it. I know my listeners would love to hear about this because it's very unique. You have a nice take on true crime.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, the story of Cold Case Jury really goes back many years to when I was a university student. I fell in love with the Sherlock Holmes stories, of course, the great fictional detective. And of course, he was set by Conan Doyle in sort of Victorian and Edwardian time in England, and that's sort of, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. And I started to read these stories, and I was fascinated by them. And I then started to think, well, are there any real-life crimes like this? And in particular, I was drawn to true crime, historical true crime. So that's true crime back in history, historical true crime, really around the Sherlock Holmes period, just because that's where my interest started. Really seeing if there was any kind of cases that inspired Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So that was the initial sparks. That got me into sort of looking around true crime and looking for true crime mysteries, if you like, the unsolved crimes, what Sherlock Holmes would say, you know, his three pipe problems. So that was the initial spark. I started my true crime research, and nothing really happened for many, many years. And then you've got to jump to a few years ago when I started to do a philosophy master's down at my local university, which is Southampton University, not far from where I live near Winchester. And I did a philosophy MA, and that sort of honed all my analytical skills, because it can be quite tough sometimes, philosophy, if you're doing analytical philosophy. And then at the end of the philosophy course, I didn't know what to do next in terms of that sort of self-learning side of things. And there was a course being run by Southampton University called Telling True Stories. And this was the course was held by Ian Gately, who is a non-fiction author. And as I embarked on that course, Ian said two things. And the first was, Two and two, not four. This is one of his biggest writing tips for all our budding writers there. Two and two, not four. And what he means by this is, obviously, don't spoon feed your reader. So if you've got two people in a room during in a scene and another couple join them, you don't say, and now there were four in the room. You know, the reader can work it out for themselves, there's four people in the room. So that's where the two and two, not four came from. So I got thinking about that and think, oh, that's a very good concept. I want to employ that in my writing. And the other thing he said was, I need you to go away now and actually come up with a short piece for the class, something that interests you, where you can demonstrate, you know, what you've learned. And so I went away and I decided to do a little story on a true crime from 1876. It's the Bravo mystery. Some of your listeners might have heard of it. That was set in London. It's not set in London. It happened in London in 1876 and actually became one of my first books. But anyway, I write a small piece about this. And I got to think about two and two, not four. You know, involve the reader, let the reader work things out for themselves. I decided, I think I know what happened in this case, although I've got huge doubts. I wonder what my readers think. Two and two, not four. Let the readers decide. So why not write a book whereby you tell the story of a true crime, this sort of historical true crime mystery, present the evidence to the reader, hopefully new, fresh evidence as well, if it can be found, and then let the reader decide what they think most likely happened. That was just the genesis of the idea of Cold Case Jury. The name, by the way, came from an old English pop programme. The BBC used to run a programme in the 1960s called Jukebox Jury. And the whole premise of that programme was the latest records by the Beach Boys or the Beatles, you know, would be reviewed by a panel, and then they would give their verdicts of hit and miss. So that was Jukebox Jury. And I thought, hold on, I'm doing like these unsolved murder mysteries here, real ones, cold cases. So hence the name Cold Case Jury.
Nice. So in this discussion, you started the genesis of this idea coming out of a course and you ran with it. How was it received initially with that first piece that you did?
The first piece really didn't go much into Cold Case Jury. The idea sprang into my head, but actually the piece that I did was more, I think, a more traditional piece. But the key point, John, was the idea was born, the seed had been planted. So as soon as I came away from that sort of 6 to 8 week course, you know, I then started to really, really work on Cold Case Jury. So the first thing I actually did was buy the domain name, because the whole point now was, hold on, how am I going to get people to actually tell me what they think happened in this book? And so hence I thought, go get a website, and then people can then just, you know, click on, you know, you have one sort of bit of the website for each of the cases that I will do, and they can then look at some more evidence online, some auxiliary information, but they could also go and vote there. So then I had to sort of build the website Cold Case Jury, and in parallel to that I started to, you know, write my first book. And I did these first of all as ebooks. I wanted to test the idea, because I didn't want to go to a publisher with this crazy idea of, well, I'll tell the reader what I think happened, but it's such a small part of the book. The whole point of the book is to get the reader to tell me what they think. And I thought, you know, what will a publisher say? They might say there's no demand for that, it's gonna be too much hard work for the reader. So I thought, I've got to test it. So let's self-publish an ebook on Amazon, get the website running so I can show a publisher that everything works. And that's what I did. So the first book that I did actually write was called Poisoning at the Priory, and that was based on the Charles Bravo case that I mentioned before. A really good poisoning case from 1876, laden with mystery. And it's set in a sort of a well-to-do family in England back in the Victorian era. So they had lots of servants, you know, and maids in the house. And that's where it becomes a real sort of like Cluedo-like or clue mystery. So that was the first ebook that I published. And then the concept worked well. I got very good feedback. People loved the concept. So then I started to write another book in the series. And then I approached a traditional publisher. In fact, I approached two publishers, and they both offered me a contract. So I actually ended up going with Mirror Books, part of a big publishing group here in the UK, and for a four-book deal. And so far, three books have been published in the Cold Case Jury series. So the Genesis idea was at the course. Then I had to test it with ebooks. So we had that platform. Kindle was there. And I did have some website skills. So I was lucky that I could actually build my own website. It's the one that actually you see today. So the whole idea then, I was putting sort of flesh on the bones.
Sure. And you proved your concept and you were able to get a traditional publishing deal, which was fantastic. That's great. Now, going back to your research phase, I think there's three, actual phases here, if I'm not mistaken. And that is researching selecting and then researching your case, then writing it out and dripping out the evidence for your readership, and then getting the feedback from the readers. Now, I do have a question about the feedback from the readers, but I want to save that at the end. Let's go over the research phase. So here you are, selecting and then doing research on your cases. Tell me about that process, because it's almost like you're doing a forensic examination of a cold case.
Absolutely. In fact, there's two phases to the research, John, and you were absolutely astute about this. First, you've got to select your case. So first of all, you've got to do research about cases, and then you've got to look at each case and winnow out ones you don't think will work for the concept. And then, of course, once you do find one that you think is going to work, then you've got to also do a lot more research on that case. So the first phase, finding the cases, I just go online. But more than that, I buy lots of old, and I mean really old, secondhand true crime books going back to, say, the 1920s and the 1930s. I look through, trying to get it, see what the cases were in there. Because obviously at the time these books were being written, they were contemporary. They were cold cases or mysteries, but they were obviously from the 1920s or 1930s or even before. And of course, that's the era I'm particularly interested in. I'm particularly interested in true crime mysteries pre-1950. I just think it gives enough distance from today. It gives a lovely historical stage for all of the books, very different to today. We can discuss some of what the police investigations were like during some of these eras. Very, very different from today. And so it's not pre-1950, it's enough distance. And also you've got to be careful, because if you're talking with true crime, we are dealing with crimes that have real victims, and therefore we have descendants and relatives of the people who died still alive today, and who still can be affected by the cases. But thankfully the distance is quite large. It's about 70 years now at least, and so hopefully some of those raw feelings are now sort of a bit less raw, but because I don't really want to be doing contemporary true crime, where I think some of these emotions of the victims' families can be very raw indeed. For me, perhaps it's a very British thing, but it's a little bit intrusive. So that's why I prefer, again, the historical ones. But I think the whole concept of Cold Case Jury, as well as obviously the bits about the reader actually having the ability to almost decide the ending, if you like. But it is the history with mystery. It's that combination that I really love. So I'm researching these old books. I go up to records offices like Q in the National Archive, Q in London, with some ideas based on these books, and then see if they've got any police files on the cases. Now, this is very important to me, John, because to write a book, a whole book on one case, you're writing in high definition. You have to get the detail. And the way to get a detail is to have a police file. So you have the police reports, the witness statements, everything really that the police documented during their investigation of that crime. And it's obviously we're talking normally about a murder. Mm-hmm. So a murder investigation. If you don't have that police file, typically you cannot write in high definition. You do not have the detail. And one thing your listeners might be interested to know, that even if you've got the full trial transcript, the whole record of the trial, if there was a trial, that is, it doesn't go into anywhere near the detail that the police file have. Because why? Because the barristers during that trial will be winnowing the evidence to make their case. They're only interested in the black and white. They're only interested, can I get my client off, or can I get this defendant, to be found guilty by the jury? Mm-hmm. They're only interested in the black and white. As a writer and as a reader, you're interested in the shades of grey. And that normally comes from the police file. So that's why I like to go up to the National Archives once I've got some ideas in my mind about which sort of case would make a good cold case jury story. So which cases do make a good cold case jury story? Well, first of all, they need to really be unsolved or have a verdict that's open to doubt. That's very important. It's no good presenting the cold case jury with an obvious case. I think you might call it a slam dunk or whatever in America. You know, it's something that's so obvious, right. It's not worth putting, in front of the reader. So it's got to have that element of mystery about it as well. So it's an unsolved case that's intriguing. There's no real formula for it, John. It's just that gut feeling, really. When you read about something and read more about something, yeah, this is going to really work. I can see how there's at least three different sort of versions of how this murder could have been committed with perhaps two or three different suspects. So once I've had that yes moment that this is the case that I want to investigate, I will look to see if there's any books written on the case. And by the way, it doesn't faze me in any shape or form if there's been many, many books written on the case. In fact, that's actually sometimes a good thing for me, because it normally means there's been many more writers with many different theories. Because normally when you read a true crime book, person writes the book because they have an idea in mind. They have a theory about how this true crime murder mystery, what happened in it and how to solve it. And of course you get different views. And that's very good for me, because I can then use those ideas fully acknowledged in the cold case jury books, where I reconstruct how, the murder or crime might have occurred according to these different vantage points, these different perspectives.
I had just two things there that I wanted to interject if I could. And I didn't want to take you off your role, but I think it will help you on your role. Is that, you're doing your research. Did the newspapers of the day play into this? Were you able to research newspaper accounts that done by journalists of the various crimes to see if they, since they were contemporary with the crimes, were gathering leads that may have later on, not made itself into the police file?
That's a very, very good question. Yes, I love looking at old newspapers. I'm absolutely fascinated by them. I don't know why, but I prefer reading a newspaper from 1930 to today. I have no idea why. I'm just fascinated by the sense of history of it all. And what you find is, yes, you do get some very interesting stories in the newspapers. But what I have tended to find is that the newspapers misreport the facts. I'm not saying it's in any way deliberate, John. I'm just saying they got a breaking news story here, or they're covering this crime over a few weeks or even months, and they've got copy to fill, and they will ask questions, and I think they're doing their job diligently, but you will find that actually the newspaper reports do tend to have more factual errors. Obviously the police file, normally you can normally take as gospel that what's in the file did happen. I'm not saying that all the witness statements are true or anything like that, but I'm saying there was a witness and they were interviewed by the police and here's the evidence for it. So generally speaking, yes, but what the newspaper reports will give you, again, we talk about writing in high definition, they will give you some more detail that you might not get in a police statement, because the police statement are interested, about what the witness, did, heard or said or whatever. Whereas a newspaper report, you get a bit more colour, right. A little bit more about the witness, the description of the witness, if it's a trial, what they were wearing, and just you get more context for the case from reading the newspapers. So the newspapers are brilliant at providing that really good historical context. The police file gives me not only that, but it gives me more. It gives me what I'd call the solid data of the case.
Now, the other question I had with relate to this is about the various books that are written. If the story was attractive enough for other writers, how do you separate what is the writer's recitation of facts versus the writer's speculation? Is that something that you find, is it by reading the different accounts of the incident to winnow out which basically is seen as being facts, and what is the different writers' bent or speculation on it?
Yeah, very good question. I can answer that in two words: police file. That's where I will go back to. Seriously, that will be almost like the Rosetta Stone, you know, for looking at the case and trying to interpret it, what is fact and what is bias. What you normally find is the police file is there. Other authors can look at it as well. And what I have found is if you've got a traditional true crime book and an author has a particular theory about who murdered, you know, the victim, John or Jane Doe, whatever, and how it was done, they tend to what I call winnow the evidence. That is, they will, and I think you could also call it sharpening and leveling. That is, you sharpen the evidence that supports your case. And you tend to ignore or downplay the evidence or arguments that falsify it or go against it. So what you'll find is that the writers tend not to blatantly disregard the facts or will blatantly mislead the reader. But by the process of winnowing, they're just supporting their argument. What I like to do is the cold case jury books is actually give you everything, you know. So I try to be as impartial as I can. And therefore, reading lots more books, consulting with the police file and indeed the newspapers, as you correctly pointed out, gives me a good feeling for these what are the facts of the case. So in one of the books we will discuss later, as a good example of how a writer winnowed the evidence. So if you want that example now, I can give it to you now, or we can do it when you discuss the book.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So one of our books is called Move to Murder, and it's on a fascinating case from 1931 in Liverpool. Indeed, I would go far as to say it's probably the most baffling unsolved murder in British criminal history. I mean, there were a few contenders, but it's certainly up there, and I think it's probably the most baffling. And it says many, many books have been written over the last 80 years or so. And it's basically the story concerns a insurance agent called Mr. Wallace and his dead wife, Julia Wallace, was found bludgeoned to death in their front room. And I'll give you more details on this fascinating case later. But the point I'm trying to make is that really the camps fall into two sides. Wallace is guilty or Wallace is innocent. And if he's innocent, then who else did it?
Right.
And one of the authors, and I'm not going to mention his name, just to be very, very discreet. One of the authors thought Wallace did it. And he got all the evidence to show that Wallace did it. And it's a very, very well-marshaled, well-written book. But the other prime suspect is an acquaintance of Wallace called Gordon Parry. And when it came to Gordon Parry, he wasn't quite so forthcoming with all the data in the police file. So Parry had an alibi for the night of the murder. And very important in this case, as you will hear later, is a phone call that was made on the night before the murder. And Parry misled the police to his whereabouts on the night of the call. So the call is very important. And but, you know, the author really didn't want to tell the his readers that. So he basically skipped over that bit. But it's very important. It's very important. It's very important. It's one of those bits. You can say, oh, yeah, but it's not the night of the murder. It doesn't matter. There's a very important prequel to the murder in this case. And it involves this call, which we'll go into later, John. By sort of just sort of winnowing the evidence, leveling this bit, it gave the impression, I thought, to the reader that there was no other suspect, really, apart from Wallace. So, but it's not quite true. And what's more interesting, I think, is the police knew about that this suspect, Gordon Parry, had misled them about the whereabouts of one of the knights in question, but they didn't follow it up.
Hmm. Well, you know, it's not uncommon for either the police to have a narrow view of a case or to pick their suspect quickly and ignore exculpatory evidence, or it's not uncommon for a writer to decide that they're going to go a certain way and they're going to and be damned the evidence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you're spot on again, because in my personal opinion, that's exactly what the Liverpool Police Force did in 1931. They believed it was a domestic. And of course, they might be right on this. I'm not saying they're wrong, but they basically had Wallace in their sights from the get-go, from almost the moment they stepped over the threshold of the house.
Okay.
And therefore, it was a case of getting the evidence to prove it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they were very interested at all in talking to people or finding out anything that might actually weaken the case. And this is very important, John, going back to the 1930s in British policing. And indeed, much later on, until quite recently, I would say, sort of the modus operandi of the police was really, well, our job is to nick someone for this crime. Mm. Not necessarily what it is today. Certainly, I'd say in modern British policing, it is, you know, we have to get the evidence and then hand that over to what's called the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK, and they decide whether they're going to do any, you know, prosecution of it. I think that shift in policing has been, you know, quite dramatic, along, of course, with forensic analysis, which is obviously the other side of the investigation. But that sort of role of the police has changed. But back in the 1930s, almost certainly to a cop, as we'd say, to a policeman, you know, they thought their job was to get someone for that crime, you know, and, you know, they might have got the right man in this case, but I say the nature of the investigation was quite flawed in many respects.
I see. Now, the second thing is that you've done your research, you've looked at every available scrap of information on the case so that you're giving your reader the opportunity to see the entire stage, to see the entire scene, to be able to be almost there themselves 70, 100 years ago. How does the evidence or dripping out the evidence play into this, that so that the two plus two equals four? Two plus two. How did you
two,
say?
Not four. Two and two, not four. Yeah, right. How does it play out? Yeah. Well, first of all, I had to come up with the structure of the books. And this is probably going back to what we talked about first. And I decided what I want to do is be quite dramatic and dramatized stories or the different theories and the events leading up to the murder and its aftermath in the first part of a book, part one. Part two, I actually wanted to present evidence, documentary evidence and photographic evidence and diagrams and maps to the reader as if they were a real juror. Now, obviously, I can't do all of the evidence, clearly, but I obviously pick out the most important documents, maps, diagrams to put in an evidence file. And this evidence file is not footnotes to the story. I'm saying to the reader, look, I've given you, you know, a dramatic account, a bit like a historical novel, how the first part reads, the story. Now look at the evidence, how the story, you know, what the story's being based on. And then the third part is a very, very, very slim part, the slimmest part of the book by far. And that's called My Judgment. And that's literally where I say, look, this is what I think's happened and why. But here's other people's views on people who might have written books on the same case. Here's what they think. And then obviously I invite the reader to go online to tell me what they think, and they can see how other people have voted as well and what other jurors think. And then I just sort of give an epilogue at that section as well, just summing it up, say, well, what happened to the main characters after all this drama? But going back to your question, which is really about part one, which is the story. So what I like to do is literally try and take the reader back in time as if they were there witnessing the event. So witnessing the events surrounding the murder, the events leading up to it, introducing the main characters, as if you were reading an historical novel, really. It's much more of a flowing narrative. But I will interrupt that narrative to say, members of the cold case jury, what you've just witnessed is actually very important. The time that this milk was delivered, for instance, which is a very important thing from Move to Murder, is crucial because it's the last time that Julia Wallace was seen alive. And so I will go back over that scene that I've just dramatized for the reader to point out key bits of evidence for discussion, and then, you know, obviously later in the book I will discuss it more. And then after I've done the lead up to the murder, actually described the murder factually, I then other chapters then are dedicated to different theories of how the murder might have occurred, might have happened, and who did it. And so again, it's this. I love the juxtaposition of different vantage points. And that's what doing that does. So, you know, you see obviously from Move to Murder, which is about the Wallace case from 1931. You see Wallace, or you read rather, you read Wallace, you know, committing the crime, why he did it, how he did it. And then in another chapter after that, you will see a different theory about someone else committed the murder, how he did it, etc. So you're getting the same kind of evidence, the same murder scene, but from different vantage points. And I've always been drawn to that kind of narrative, that kind of storytelling as well. So that's another important part of Cold Case Jury. So that's how I write the books. I try and dramatize them, but keeping to the facts of the case and to the theories of the case. and then present a very factual evidence file. Sometimes, and hopefully in all my books so far, this has happened, hopefully it will continue in the future, I present evidence that's never been published before. So the reader gets that feel, oh gosh, this didn't even make it to trial, you know, and I now actually can read this. Or so for Move to Murder, for instance, you actually get to read extracts from Wallace's unpublished memoir, never been published before. So you actually see the man's thoughts after the crime, because he was actually tried and acquitted after an appeal. So you get his thoughts of it, never been published before, things like that. And in Move to Murder, one of the very important exhibits that I published was the original post-mortem. I think you call it autopsy, the original post-mortem report, which had never actually been published before, not in its entirety, and with some really key information in there. So that's what I like to do. So then I think the reader has really been taken on a journey. They've had the narrative. They've been immersed in the story. They then are treated, you know, like an adult, if I can say that, like a real juror, given some of the evidence, and then they can read my view. And of course, the whole point of Cold Case Jury is you don't get to the book, and sometimes you read true crime books, you think, oh, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with what the author's saying there. And I find that very deflating, a bit frustrating. But with Cold Case Jury, you might disagree with my view of the case 100% or 180 degrees. Doesn't matter, because you can obviously then go onto the website and say, yeah, no, I don't agree with that. I'm plumping for this theory as what happened. So in a way, each reader can decide the ending for themselves, which of course they would do in a traditional book, I accept that, but this is just a more formal, more interesting, more interactive way of saying, hey, what do you think? Tell me your views. And of course, what I do get as well is people writing to me as well.
Well, I had a question about that, and I was starting to ask my question in my mind when you just added that little part about people writing you about questions. So why don't you tell me about that first, and then it might answer my question.
Yeah. One thing that I really like is getting feedback from readers. I do get some really, really nice emails. Sometimes they might be connected to the case in some way. Perhaps it's a long lost relative, was a police officer, or even, you know, a relative distant relative of the victim. So I get some insights there. I normally get a lot of ideas about what happened in the crime or what this bit of evidence mean that I certainly didn't think of, you know, when I wrote the book. So I then start a dialogue with these readers, you know, saying this is a really interesting idea or whatever, and with a dialogue. And that's very interactive and very pleasing. So I am not invested intellectually in whether I get the right answer. No one knows with these cases, John, what the right answer is. There is one, we don't know it. What I'm invested in is, have I written this book fairly? Have I written it in a way that engages the reader, that makes them ask these questions? And you know, the answer seems to be, at least initially, is yes, they do. They do read it, they do vote, and they do come back, you know, asking questions if they have any, or you know, actually saying, I think you're wrong, I think there's another theory you haven't considered. And then they will, you know, put that theory to me. So, and what I have got, because I've got the website, I am posting sort of what I call extras. So I post other articles that I've written on the case, might be to do with some evidence. In the Move to Murder case, for instance, I'm quite a fan of Forensic Files, a great US show that ran, you know, I think about 10 to 12 years ago. And there's a very interesting case on there that had some striking parallels to the Wallace case. So I wrote an article on my website called The Ratley Parallel. It was to do with the murder of I've forgotten her name. I think it was Ella Ratley, down in Florida in 2007. Very, very interesting. Had some very interesting parallels to the Wallace case. So I put that up, drew those parallels out. So people can go back to the website and find out what's happened since the book's been published as well.
Well, then my question then continues is that when you said that there is a discourse or a dialogue between you mm-hmm. and the reader, is this a public dialogue so that the other readers can see the conversation? Or do they chip in? I mean, is there any crosstalk between the readers on your website, or is it just, you know, you to them, them to you?
Okay, for the emails, yes, that's private, you know, and just one-to-one. I do, though, sometimes go onto public forums and therefore it's one too many and it's publicly viewable. So it's both, John. It just depends on the case and what's out there about the case. If there's already a forum on it, I tend to go and use that forum as well. So I participate in those. But it's great, and you really get the full spectrum of views, different personalities. You know, and I'm very what I'm really interested in as well is asking people, you know, what is the one key bit of evidence, you know, to support your theory, or the key bit of evidence that made you, you know, deliver the verdict that you did. And it's fascinating. You just get such a variety of views. I remember one of my good friends is a former detective chief superintendent here in the UK. He was actually the top detective in Hampshire, which is the county which I live in. And he said, he's doing his investigations. If there was any kind of incident, let's say it's a car accident, and you have three witnesses, you'd get three different accounts.
Oh, sure.
And it's a bit like that when you've got a juror. It really is. They will pick up on different things for different reasons and weight it differently. Everybody is different, and I find it absolutely fascinating, the psychology of how people approach the cases.
No, you're right. And to that point, I'm thinking about how you said something earlier about, I didn't think about that. And I wonder how many detectives, if they were, if these conversations were contemporaneous with their investigation, how many detectives would say, oh, I didn't think about that?
Or, yeah.
You know, so it just seems like there's just such a wealth of opportunity there to have not so much a crowdsource of the investigation, but a laying out of the investigative facts and having people from different backgrounds, different viewpoints weigh in on it. And from their experiences and from their intuition, and I know a philosophical discussion about intuition can be had, but basically, they're bringing something to the table that the way the copper looks at it just doesn't always, he's not always looking at, or she's not always looking at it with open eyes. And to have somebody else Correct. Bring in an idea is great. So,
yeah, absolutely. I really like that whole idea, the whole genesis, that the more people you get with different backgrounds, in some ways, I personally believe the more accurate the overall verdict of the cold case jury per case will be. I'm a firm believer in that. I believe the broader background, you know, all different people, you know, different countries, different cultures, different ages, obviously the two different genders, you just find that the wider net you cover, I think the more accurate the kind of verdict will be, given the evidence we have and given the story and the evidence that I've presented. Firm believer in that. So yes, that's one of the things I think cold case jury does bring. Instead of having a jury of 12, you've got juries, you know, sizes in the hundreds and hopefully soon thousands. Yes, a much, much bigger sample that you get with these 12 jurors.
Now, is there any particular example that you'd like to cite about this particular case of somebody, you know, giving you some startling insight that, you know, had been lost to all the other people?
I wouldn't say I've actually come across absolutely startling insight. I think it's more very different interpretations. You know, I might be thinking so one sort of interpretation of the evidence, and people come up and say, "Oh no, this could have happened." For instance, in Move to Murder, when Julie Wallace is found bludgeoned to death in her front room, and one of the curious clues, in fact, one of the most curious clues that's ever appeared, I think, in British criminal history, is there is a bloodied Macintosh stuffed under her right shoulder. She's lying on the floor, of course. And the prosecution, the police at the time, believed that Wallace, the husband, had actually stripped down naked or stripped down to his underwear and put the Macintosh on to minimize or eliminate any blood spatter onto his own body. Mm. Okay, then he gets dressed and goes out, and he just stuffed it under there. And so most people think either the Macintosh was worn by someone, by the killer, probably Wallace. It might have been, it is possible, that Julia Wallace had it around her shoulders when she was attacked, and it was in the room like that. But one person said, no, it was probably, you know, probably used as a shield, that it wasn't actually worn, but it might have been draped over the arm. So the Macintosh falls to the floor, this overcoat flows to the floor, a bit like, if you would, like a riot shield in a way, but obviously made of material, made of this overcoat. It's actually protecting you while you, well, commit a murder. It doesn't necessarily have to be worn. So that there are, you know, and I didn't think of that for one moment that it would have been used like that. So it's very, very interesting. That's just one very small, tiny example. But you get people coming back with all different ideas on every sort of evidential aspect. So it's not just the verdict that people differ on. So that is why having a great, very broad readership, I think, really, really is interesting. And could it have helped, you know, back in the day? Absolutely. Mm. If the police were open to ideas, and they weren't so perhaps blinkered in this particular case, at least this Wallace case, of pinning it on Wallace, then yeah, I think you might have got more evidence in that case. But that's just the one book. We only talked about the one book, which is Move to Murder.
Yeah.
There are two others, if I may talk about those as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So Move to Murder is actually the latest book. That's the bludgeoning of Julia Wallace in 1931 in Liverpool. That is, I think, just a real-life Agatha Christie. You really, you know, because it all starts with a phone call the night before, which is given to Mr. Wallace as he's at his chess club, and it tells him to go and visit a potential customer 4 miles from his house the following night. So he does that. He goes and visits this customer the following night, but found the customer's name and the address are fictitious. So the call and the message left at the chess club was a complete ruse, a hoax. That's when he comes back, and that's when he finds his wife bludgeoned to death in the front room. So the police believe he actually made the call himself to the chess club and then arrived later to pick up the message from about 1931. So you must get out of your mind anything to do with modern communications. We're going back to what are called candlestick telephones.
Right.
And yeah, and stuff like that. So it was quite unusual to get a telephone message. And the police believe that he actually went into a public phone box, called the chess club, got to write down the message and give it to him, and it's all part of a very, very clever alibi. So that is why it's a bit like an Agatha Christie. So I do recommend your listeners, if you're interested in that kind of, you know, book, then, you know, Move to Murder won't disappoint them, just because the case is so intrinsically interesting. So that's the third book, and that came out in November in 2018. The first book was The Green Bicycle Mystery, and this is a very interesting case, again from England, Leicestershire, which is in the middle of England, in 1919, just after the First World War ended. And the basic premise here is a young girl is found dead in the middle of a lonely country lane. She's lying on the road next to a bicycle, and from the body into a nearby wooden gate that leads to a field, there are bloodied bird tracks, and there's more bloody bird tracks on the top of the gate. And this gate goes into an adjacent meadow, and there's been a path beaten in this meadow. At the end of this meadow, would you believe, end of this path, there is a dead crow. And so this is how this case starts, which is really much, and I do draw the parallel in my book a lot, a bit like a Sherlock Holmes starting of a Sherlock Holmes story. And that's very interesting, and it's basically calls the prime suspect to be a man on a green bicycle, and the police just could not find this guy on the green bicycle. It took them 8 months and a huge stroke of luck to get him. But I won't give any spoilers, I'm just saying, and he still might not have done it, but that was the prime suspect. Mm. So that's The Green Bicycle Mystery. That was from 1919. And again, the policing and the forensics, completely different, John, to how you would know it. For instance, when the body was found, it was put onto a fence. It's put onto a milk float. So it was a horse-drawn cart with milk urns in it. And the body was then transported to a disused cottage. And that's where the body laid overnight, because the girl was not actually identified at that stage. So again, it's just fascinating to see this history and how things were done, you know, 100 years ago. And then the second book in the series, Death of an Actress, is very different again. This is set in 1947, but it's not set in any country, because it regards the disappearance at sea of a beautiful actress called Gay Gibson. And as this ocean liner was steaming its way from Cape Town in South Africa to Southampton, about halfway along the journey, Gay Gibson goes missing, body presumed lost overboard. And the prime suspect is a dashing steward called James Cam, who had a reputation for many dallying dalliances with female passengers, sometimes whether they were wanted or not, I might add. He becomes the prime suspect, and he comes out with a really fascinating story. In the end, due to some very interesting police tactics in the interview room, he actually confesses that he was in the cabin when she died, but that she died naturally during consensual sex. And then, because he panicked, because he couldn't be found in the cabin with a passenger, let alone a dead one, he pushed her body through the porthole, which is, of course, a lot of people have a huge problem with that next step. And that's what he did, believe it or not. It's an incredible story. But he absolutely maintained the innocence that he did not murder her, that she actually died of natural causes. So in that book, I do a lot of research into Gay Gibson's health and actually find out that she did, believe it or not, even though she's a 21-year-old, she did actually suffer with some health problems. So his story might be true, i.e. that it was misadventure or she died from an accident. He still could have murdered her. There's plenty of evidence to say, look, he's not telling the whole truth. Although it is a third way for the cold case jury to vote, which is actually manslaughter, that he was actually going into the room. He was up to the cabin, rather. He was up to no good. And perhaps during a bit of a fight, a bit of a struggle, she then had some kind of seizure. Again, all is explained in the book what it would be. And obviously, Cam thought she had died, disposed of the body, but, you know, maintained his innocence because, as far as he's concerned, he didn't actually strangle her, kill her, intentionally killed her, but obviously she died during the struggle. So those are the three sort of verdicts you have for Deaf and Actress. So those are the three books. They're three very, very different. One's a shooting, one's a bludgeoning, one's a suspected or alleged strangulation. But unfortunately, they all involve dead women. The next book will definitely be a dead male. But at the moment, It is women, which is a sad. Often, I don't know the statistics, but I guess more women die at the hands of, I don't know, murderers. Perhaps men. I don't know. Perhaps in the States it's different, with obviously gun laws being different and everything. I just don't know. But I think that's certainly true in the UK.
Well, I think you've hit on several different high points here. First of all, it's British. I mean, I'm not going to say we here in the United States have a fondness for British mysteries, and I think the Brits have a fondness for British mysteries as well. But besides that, you're giving them older historical cases, so this is not something that's ripped from today's headlines, and it gives them a chance to be a dispassionate viewer, a juror of the facts. You're giving them the evidence, obviously, dripping that out as the case goes on, making sure that they see how the scene could unfold from different theories, and then the individual readers weigh in as to what their vote is. And sometimes they give you back by email their own thoughts and ideas, and something that you may not even thought about, or no other writer on this story, you know, whether it be the tabloids or the previous writers had thought about. So I just had a quick question about Move to Murder. Was it determined who the Macintosh was owned by?
Yes, it was. It was owned by the husband, and it was hanging in the hall just outside the front room where the body was found. So obviously it could have been Mr. Wallace himself, but obviously it isn't beyond the realms of possibility that an intruder or another killer picked it up and, you know, put it over her head, you know, to muffle the her cries or whatever. It's, you know, and that's where people have lots and lots of different theories. But it was his Macintosh that was found.
Okay. Well, excuse me. I just thought that was a question that came to my mind. Here, you have me sucked in now. I'm looking at this and saying, oh, well, what about this? What about that?
Yeah.
So now this is a great idea. I think you've done a nice idea of taking a proof of concept and seeing if it would work. And it did work, obviously, because you got a traditional publishing deal. You're getting readers to buy the books with the idea that they're going to be involved in more than just a pleasant read, that they're going to have to do a little bit of heavy lifting. And
if they want to. They don't have to, of course. They can just read like a traditional book and just accept my view and then put it to one side. But obviously what I'm hoping is the start of writing, the way the book's presented and structured, they will engage with it a bit like you have today, John. Mm. And therefore you want to actually have your verdict. You do want to have your you're saying, but they don't have to. It's still got my view at the end. It's like a traditional book would have, but there's so much more to it than that.
Yeah. Now, here in the United States, I hate to bring up this one case, but it's probably the case that has engaged the American public the most, or at least of my generation, and that is the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Here you have you have a case that has been gone over, to borrow a phrase, 19 ways to Sunday, and part of that also is that you know there's some thought that the Warren Commission report, which is the official document, is somewhat of a flawed item, and it didn't help that last year or the year before, I forget which, when it became time for there to be a unveiling of public records by law, the sitting president decided to hold off on some of that information, thinking that it might be damaging to the investigative firms. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm sorry, this is my little stand on the soapbox. What exactly is going to be embarrassing or damaging to an investigation that took place over 50 years ago? And it just boggles my mind. But anyhow, I think that's a question.
My view there, I do know the Kennedy case very well. I have studied it in depth. So I do know. And I would say if some things aren't actually being published, it must be something very embarrassing.
Yes.
Yes. And, so I know there are different theories about there could be one. One theory is about it was a rifle, but in the Secret Service car behind the president might have actually accidentally fired the fatal bullet, and that certainly would explain the scenes in the Parkland Hospital, the scenes at the autopsy, I think it was in Washington, and perhaps it explains why there are some documents that aren't coming forward. I cannot believe. And this happens in Britain all the time as well, by the way. So it's not just in America. In fact, I think America is actually one of the most transparent nations. I really do. I think you've got a great constitution. But over here, it's a little bit more, I'm going to say less open. Some will disagree, but I think it's a bit more secretive. I think what could really hurt American national security over a 50-year-old? Really, I don't buy it like you. I mean, what is there?
Now, Anthony, you said that you said something about a rifle, and we phased out somehow on our transatlantic connection. Yeah. You phased out there. So, could you repeat that part about the rifle again that you said something about in this case? Go ahead.
Yeah. So one of the theories of the Kennedy case is, of course, that a Secret Service agent who was riding in the follow-up car to President Kennedy picked up his rifle, and it was that gun that fired the fatal bullet. So, and of course, that would explain a lot of the flexing things about the Kennedy case. You know, the scene in the Parkland Hospital. Let's face it, one of the biggest flawed autopsy in the history, you know, of American murders. It was so flawed. It really was flawed. So what I'm trying to say is if there was that, even that was partially true, even approximates the truth, John, that might be very embarrassing to the Secret Services. So that might well be the reason they withhold such information. What I can't believe is that there is a present and clear threat to American national security based on a 50-year-old case like the assassination of Kennedy. I personally can't buy that.
Well, your fellow friend across the pond here agrees with you, because I've looked at that since I was old enough to think about it rationally, or not rationally. So where I'm looking at, analytically. I didn't take the Warren report at face value. And then on top of that, if you're holding back evidence now, of information that is directly related to reports, or memos coming out of the investigative services, then how does that play into the basis or the foundation of the Warren report? How does that change, you know, that information? So I think there's a lot more to be said there. And and I hope in my lifetime, and I'm taking my vitamins and I'm exercising regularly, that we will find out what really truly happened that day in Dealey Plaza. And but I digress, because that is something that the Americans, I believe, have been fixated on, and probably is our greatest, and I hate to say it, but I think it's truly an unsolved murder. But it's easy to point the finger at Lee Harvey Oswald. He was an easy dupe in this matter, but that's just to say that he either acted or acted alone. Well, you know, that's another story. But anyway, that's a story for another day, Anthony.
So absolutely.
Tell me, how can my listeners get in touch with you? How can they learn more about your books? These are very fascinating stories that you've told, and I think that they would love to have a chance to find out more about what you do and how you do it.
Great. It's very, very easy. Just go to coldcasejury.com. So that's all one word, coldcasejury.com. That's my website. You can find out a little bit about me. Some Q&As that I've done in the past. You can find out about all the three books that are published so far. You get some of the evidence files are published online. Some of those additional extra articles are there. It takes you to Amazon. I think it takes you to Amazon UK, actually, for where you can buy the books. But you can definitely get the Kindle books in Amazon.com, and you can actually buy the paperbacks in America. Unfortunately, there is no American publisher as yet, so they are quite expensive because they've got to be imported, so I do apologize for that. But the Kindles, I think, are quite reasonably priced. Coldcasejury.com. It's got all the information you could want, all three books, a bit about me, and say much more importantly about the cases and additional information that may have come to light since the publication of the books.
And is there an email address or a way to contact you that you would prefer?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a contact right on the webpage. So that's all there. There's a contact button there. I'm also on Twitter, which of course is international. And my handle there is @CCJury on Twitter, if you want to follow me on Twitter. But it's a very interesting project. I'm really glad I've started this whole thing off. I hope I don't sound I can blow my own trumpet, but I think it would make such a good TV series. Now we're going to the next wave of interactive TV, John, and I think, you could combine period drama with expert panel discussions, with audience participation, a map on an app on a mobile phone so people can actually, interact with it. I think, true crime is a huge genre in Britain. I know it is in the States as well, because I also get Netflix. I know from what's on there that it is a big genre. And I just think, I think it don't just have to be obviously British cases. One of the cases that I'm thinking of doing next is actually an Australian one, and there's several in America that I want to do. So as long as I can keep writing and the publisher will keep publishing, there will be more countries than just Britain, but they will be all pre-1950. That I can guarantee you, because that is the premise, the whole concept of Cold Case Jury. It's where history meets mystery meets reality, if you like.
I like that ending. I really appreciate that. Anthony, thank you very much for being on the show today. I thank you very much. I know my listeners will find this to be very interesting.
Well, thank you, John. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Bruce Sackman. Bruce is a renowned medical investigator specializing in tracking down medical serial killers and is in demand as a consultant on that subject all over the world. He is a former special agent in charge of the Northeast Field Office Criminal Investigations Division, United States Department of Veteran Affairs, Office of the Inspector General, where he was responsible for criminal investigations in 295 Veterans Affairs facilities. He's a licensed private investigator and conducts internal investigations for one of the largest medical centers in the world. He is president of the Society of Professional Investigators. This episode is the first of a two-part exploration into his cases that are highlighted in his recently published book, Behind the Murder Curtain. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to johnhoda.com and click on the podcast page. There you will find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they're available for you free with your email subscription to the podcast as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes from my book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here is my ask. If you were informed, inspired, and entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Please take a moment to share this podcast with your friends, then leave a review on your favorite podcatcher. If you like to leave a comment, you can do so on the website at www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Thank you so much, and have a great day.